we move to the final case this morning, which is United States versus Nanya.
It's like being back in district court with the defendant's family.
Ms. Carpenter?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Carpenter, and I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender Program in the Western Division, and I represent Mr. John Nanya in this matter. Mr. Nanya is asking that this court vacate the sentence which was imposed in the district court and that the cause be remanded for further proceedings. It's our position, first, that the sentence imposed in this matter was procedurally unreasonable. First, because the district court did not correctly calculate the sentencing guidelines that were applicable in this case, particularly when it comes to the application of 5G 1.3. That guideline deals with defendants who are serving undischarged terms of imprisonment at the time that sentence is imposed in the district court. The plain reading of 5G 1.3b mandates its application in this case, and if B is to apply, it would direct the court to that it shall impose its sentence concurrently to the undischarged term of imprisonment. And if C applies, the district court then has its discretion to impose its sentence partially concurrent, fully concurrent, or in whatever manner it deems fit. There's three elements that must be in existence for B to apply, and it's our position that all three apply in this or exist in this case. First, the defendant must be serving an undischarged term of imprisonment, and that's clear in this case that Mr. Nanya was. The Winnebago County Circuit Court of Illinois, Judge Truitt, had imposed a 72-year sentence upon Mr. Nanya for which he was serving.
Have the appeals been exhausted in that case?
I believe they have, Your Honor. He was serving that sentence of 72 years, and that was imposed to be served at a rate of 85% at the time of which he was sentence was imposed in this matter.
It's a good time, some kind of calculation?
Right. It's not a day-for-day credit. It's a similar to the federal sentence, which is 85%.
How old is he?
At the time, currently I believe he's 48 years old. I think at the time of the sentence imposition, he was 46 in state court. He would be 103 years old at the time he's first eligible for parole in the state sentence, which would be November of 2067.
That's the new 50, I suppose.
We'll see. Judge, the next element that has to be met is that the term of imprisonment for which he was serving has to be for relevant conduct. In this case, the government and the defendant agreed in their plea agreement, and no one objected at the sentencing hearing, and probation found that all of the convictions for which Mr. Nanya was serving an undischarged term of imprisonment were in fact relevant conduct. We know that because it was agreed to in the plea agreement, and the pre-sentence report found it that way when they failed to apply any criminal history category points. They said that it did not reach that qualification because those convictions were for conduct that were part of the instant offense. And the sentencing guidelines tell us that if it's part of the instant offense, that means that it's relevant conduct.
And they were trying to go outside of the same period of time for which he was convicted and sentenced for the 72 years. And they said there was additional time beyond that that was not accounted for in that sentence.
That's what the district court said after, though, adopting the...
So it's conflicting with what the agreement was, or yes, are you understanding?
I believe it's conflicting with the agreement, but it's also conflicting with what the district court initially said in its sentencing hearing, which was that it was adopting the factual findings and conclusions of the pre-sentence report, and it was adopting the sentencing guideline calculations within the report. In doing that, the court is showing that it believes that those convictions were relevant conduct. But then later the court seems to put an onus on the defendant to show that the specific acts that Mr. Nunea was convicted of in state court were the exact same instances of which he was before the district court to be sentenced. But that's not in the plain reading of the guideline. There's no time issue within the guidelines. And the time frames do overlap. They're not totally coextensive, but they do overlap. And there's no... Well, I would move on then to say that we know that it is an undischarged term of imprisonment. We know that there was relevant conduct that that sentence was for. We also have to show that...
But there's other conduct in the federal conviction, right? There are other young girls or young children. There are other acts that are not necessarily part of the state conviction.
That's correct. But the plain reading of the 5G says that what we're talking about that there is for the sentence of imposition that's undischarged. Are those cases relevant conduct? Are those cases used to increase the offense level on the instant case? And obviously, there were four victims in the sentencing calculation. Two victims from state court were the same. But right, there were additional ones. But when we're considering the application of 5G 1.3, the plain language shows that you're only to look at the sentences of imposition on the undischarged sentence. Again, regarding whether the relevant conduct in the convictions for which he was serving a sentence were used to increase the offense level, in the plea agreement and in the sentencing hearing, the defendant and the government were in agreement that there are specific offense characteristics that applied, and the probation office also found this. There were multiple enhancements. Some were for sexual molestation or for the sadistic conduct. Those stem from the course of conduct out of the state court for which he was serving a sentence for. In the PSR, there's no reference to a particular act of sexual molestation for that enhancement, nor is there a particular reference to a time frame. The district court, again, stated its affirmance for that in saying that they were adopting the guideline calculations and the factual findings within the PSR, but then goes on to contradict itself when looking at the application note saying, well, it's not all relevant conduct. If it wasn't all relevant conduct, the district court could have applied criminal history points to various parts of those convictions, but did not do so. A proper guideline application in this case would result in a concurrent sentence, and it would have adjusted the sentence for the time of imprisonment beginning in February of 2009, which was when the state arrest occurred, and he's been in custody ever since then.
Well, obviously not all the offenses matched, right? In fact, the identification of the victims that uses a different coding system of some sort. Can we tell from that which do match and which don't, or do we have to?
We can tell that there's specific convictions in the state court that were used to enhance the offense level in the federal sentencing, because we know AM and SM, victim A and B. But I don't believe that the plain reading of the guideline does not require that every single act match up. Rather, what it requires is that it's relevant conduct and that his sentence was enhanced because of that. And that's the case in both from the state to the federal sentence. I see that I'm entering my time of rebuttal, so I'm done. Well,
continue if you have something else you want to say.
I don't. Thank you, though, and we ask that you vacate the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Sawyer?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Catherine Sawyer on behalf of the United States. The district court correctly applied Guideline Section 5G1.3C in ordering that the below-guideline sentence run consecutively because there was conduct that the defendant was punished for in the state court that was not accounted for in the federal sentence. Those are acts other than vaginal penetration, specifically including
acts with the same girls?
With respect to victims AM and SM, yes, yeah. Your Honor.
So they were, okay, that's what I wanted to clear up. I know that there was a segment of time, and so it's put some other act you will discount it as with at a different time, but both the same girls.
I think the court is correct that there are both arguments present here. One is a temporal distinction between when the acts took place with respect to the victim AM, and the other is a distinction with respect to the actual acts alleged in the state indictment versus the federal indictment. And that's the first basis for the government's argument, that being that because the defendant was punished in state court for, with respect to AM, three discrete acts that were not accounted for in the federal sentence, those acts, and with all due respect, those acts being with respect to AM, the defendant placing his penis on AM's mouth, on her hand, and on her vagina, each of those three acts alleged in counts 1 through 3 of the state indictment were not accounted for anywhere in the federal sentence, nor were they used to enhance the defendant's federal base offense.
But there were other similar acts, I presume, that were in a different time frame. Is that it?
Well, I think...
Or does it matter if they're different time frame, if there are many acts and the state only focused on three of them?
I think both are true. I think the gravamen of our argument, and I can address the other ones, but I think the gravamen of our argument here is that we can know that the acts are different because the enhancements applied by the probation office in calculating the federal guidelines was vaginal penetration, and that's clear from the enhancements that the probation officer applied. That discrete act is nowhere charged. Whether or not it ever took place, it's not charged in the federal indictment, and he was not sentenced and punished for that conduct in
the
state.
Was there a filming at some point of him and the victim in this case? Did he actually film them performing an act?
That's correct, Your Honor. With respect to AM, the digital image 2, which is the basis for count 2 in the federal indictment, the count to which he pled guilty in this case, alleged that he photographed the vaginal penetration of AM, and that was the sentence imposed in this case. The same is also true of SM, that he was punished in state court for...
Let me go back to that.
Of course.
Was there a separate charge then with regard to that filming or photographing?
In the state indictment or the federal indictment?
Either one.
Well, there was no charge in the state indictment relating to the photography or memorialization of an act. That was the basis for count 2 to which he pled guilty in the federal case, and that is the production of child pornography, correct?
Thank you.
And the same is true with respect to AM. The discrete acts that were charged in the federal indictment, that he was punished for in state court in the state indictment, are not one for one the same as those he was sentenced for in the federal indictment. For those reasons, Your Honor, defendant cannot carry his burden with respect to that third requirement of 5G1.3b, which is that every piece of the state conduct be used to enhance his base offense level in the district court sentence. His argument fails on that point alone. The government would also submit that at its worst, it's a complex case involving multiple undischarged state sentences, which allowed the district court alternatively to find under Application Note 3D that he had the discretion to apply Section 5G1.3C of the guidelines and also impose that consecutive sentence.
Though Ms. Carpenter didn't get to it hers, I hope you'll address the substantive objection made to the reasonableness of the sentence.
I'd be happy to if the court's interested in that question.
He can't live this out. I mean, he'll start this sentence at 103.
I think that's possible, Your Honor. I think that
if you've got some proof that there's a strong possibility, otherwise, let us know.
Well, I suppose that there are individuals, Your Honor, that survive that age.
Sure.
I also think that at least the government's concern, in part at the time of sentencing, was ensuring that the defendant served a certain sentence given the uncertainty that sometimes arises in release dates in state court. I would submit, Your Honor, though, that a within or below guideline sentence is obviously entitled to a presumption of reasonableness, and I think that examining the 3553 factors that the court, I think, did diligently, it seemed to rely heavily on the egregious nature, I guess I would say, of this offense, Your Honor. This is a case where the defendant, over time and to a disturbing extent, molested and memorialized the molestation of almost every young girl that he had access to.
Well, we know of two, more than his daughter and his, and there, was the daughter, what, I don't remember, his daughter, babysitter, and stepdaughter?
Your Honor, there are no less than six, I think, between the plea agreement and the government's version, between the state indictment, the federal indictment, and the additional information in the pretrial sentence report, there are no less than six. There was a family friend, there was a family member, there was a babysitter, there was an additional family member, to leave it at that.
Did he distribute any of the videos?
Your Honor, that's unclear. Right. There is evidence that was provided in the supplementary pretrial services report that two of the victims appeared in the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's database.
It's hard to know when you found the worst person in the world. And though he's harmed all of the victims, none were killed, and there'll be another person who kills his victims and so forth. So the sentence is so enormous. How can there be any sort of marginal deterrence in the next case if this sentence stands, where he starts it at 103 and has nearly 30 years to go?
I understand, and that's a difficult question, Your Honor. I think part of the problem arises out of the nature of the guidelines in the sense that they don't really account for how many times you molest your victim. If you molest your victim once, you may as well do it 100 times because it's not going to be accounted for. And so I think that's a difficult question to answer because it almost rises and falls on the nature of how these guidelines are structured. And so I think the court, it is a long sentence, but I don't think that means that the court was required to run it concurrently. I think the court was considering the factors that it saw before it, and I think it reasonably recognized that this was an egregious set of circumstances. This was a man who repeatedly, over the course of years, robbed any sense of innocence that these young girls would have ever known, shattered any sense of security they might have had, memorialized those acts so that those images would live on beyond any pain that these individuals might have suffered. I think the court was extremely also concerned with the notion of incremental punishment, that were it to impose a concurrent sentence, there would be no recognition whatsoever of the federal conduct, and I think that was also important to the court, and I think that's an important interest to be recognized.
Even if it were partially concurrent?
I understand, but I think to a certain extent we might be having the same conversation. And I think that the court made a reasonable exercise of its discretion based on the nature of the offense, based on the number of victims, the extent of the abuse, and the court also, I think in its own mind, felt a need to dissuade others from following, and I think that is at page 15 of the sentencing transcript, to dissuade other people from engaging in similar conduct.
Let me explore something that you mentioned that I hadn't thought of before. And you mentioned the Illinois State Courts and the question of whether or not the sentence would be carried out as given. And we've had the situation in California in which it had large numbers of prisoners, and I'm not sure it made a difference of what charge they were convicted of, were released. Would that assure the federal government at least that kind of thing isn't going to happen to this fellow?
Well, that was most certainly a concern for the government as expressed in its memorandum, and I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to answer the question, but I think that the government was most certainly concerned with ensuring that the federal sentence was given meaning regardless of what happened with the state sentence.
But I think the California situation is a classic example because all those sentences are virtually wiped out, state sentences.
Correct. Which I think would vindicate the district court sentence in this case.
Thank you.
And thank you. For those reasons, the government would respectfully request that the court affirm the sentence in this case. Thank you.
Ms. Barker, I'll give you a couple more minutes if you like.
Thank you. I would like to address the substantive unreasonableness of this sentence. The sentence imposed was 1,194 months total. The court did not sentence Mr. Nunez in a bubble, nor is there anything in the record that indicates that the court was concerned that there would not be a carrying out of the Illinois state sentence. There is no reason to believe that Mr. Nunez would not serve the sentence as imposed in the state court. The sentence imposed more than tripled the statutory maximum in this case, and it created a significant unwarranted disparity between Mr. Nunez and any other defendant that's convicted under 2255A. Those defendants cannot get a sentence beyond 30 years, but in this case, imposing the sentence in the manner in which the district court did, it imposed a sentence of nearly 100 years. A 99-year sentence is what it effectively means when the district court imposed all of the 330 months consecutive to the state sentence.
I guess I find that difficult to appreciate because the state sentence is for the physical acts, that conduct, and there are some different interests involved there. I find that hard to accept. I understand it's an enormous sentence, but to say that it's completely that this judge imposed the entirety of the sentence, I think, is incorrect.
No, but he knew what the practical outcome would be of imposing the sentence in the way he did. And we don't dispute that there is a different interest. However, the court also is obliged under the 3553A factors and in the considerations under C of the guidelines to consider the sentence that was imposed, to consider the likelihood of the duration of that sentence and his likelihood of being released. And it's clear that that did not take place given this sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.